And we're very happy, very pleased tonight to have Tina Dilfey joining us, or Diffley, excuse me. She is the author of Turn Here, Sweet Corn. There we go. Tina, welcome to the Roadhouse.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, very, very nice to have you here. Tina is an organic consultant. She's an educator, a public speaker, and she's the author of a brand new 2012 memoir, Turn Here, Sweet Corn, Organic Farming Works, which was published by the University of Minnesota Press. And until 2008, she and her husband Martin ran Gardens of Egan, one of the first certified organic produce farms in the Midwest. She also had a couple of major dramatic events happen to them over the course of their careers with the farm. The first one was when their first farm was lost to suburban development and eminent domain for a school in Egan, and the second, a legal battle with the Koch pipeline or Koch refineries company. You know, it's hard for me to think of organic farming and drama together, Tina, but I finished your book, and that's a dramatic book.
There's a lot of drama there. You should hear the parts they left out.
Well, I'm hoping that we fill in a lot of those during the interview. But I was not only amazed at the drama in the book, but I was also just caught up in the passion with which you wrote it. You know, I'd start off if you could tell the folks where your name Tina came from.
You know, I was named Tina by my parents, and I never liked the name. All the Tinas I knew were the kind of women that hung out in bars and acted helpless, and they all had blonde hair, and I do have blonde hair, so that was already enough for me. So I wanted to change my name, and when I was 17, I took care of an older woman named Anita, who was a suffragette in the 20s. And she was in her 90s at the point where I cared for her. And I learned so much from her about different ways to be in the world and different ways to see myself as a woman. She really empowered me to stop giving my power away and to respect myself. So I took her name backwards. I added an A to Tina and got a Tina, which is Anita backwards. And when people hear my name or see it in print now, probably half the time they say it wrong. They say Anita, which is quite okay with me.
You know, when you glance at the name, it's almost automatic to say Anita, mm-hmm. and you almost have to train yourself, you know, to say it the way that you meant it to be. But that little story also kind of reflects what I was really impressed with initially starting out in your book was the love of tradition and where you came from, not only your own, but also your husband, Martin.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's a fourth generation on land that the family had been on since the 1850s, and they really had a family lineage. It was almost as if the land came with a handed-down family manual of all the special spots. They had names for places, and, you know, his aunts and uncles would teach him this spot is, this field is good for this crop, or be careful not to overwork this land because it's vulnerable to erosion. They really had that as a family lineage.
Now, there was a huge progression to a kind of chemical farming that happened and throughout. I'm not even sure when it started. I'm sure you do. But was the farm that you grew to love with Martin, the land that he inherited from those generations, was that always organically farmed?
It was. His uncles put it into set-aside in the 1950s, and so it rested for 20 years. And then he was able to start farming that family land in 1973. So he started farming organically, so it had never had chemicals on it. In fact, a funny story that didn't end up in the book was he wanted to join 4-H in the worst way. And the 4-H in his community, he was born in 1949, so it would have been the later 50s. They were introducing lawn chemicals to the 4-H children. So his parents wouldn't allow him to join, and they called the 4-H club the Brown Shirts in reference to the Nazis.
Oh.
And they drew parallels in his family that... the Nazis were committing genocide of people, and the 4-H was committing genocide of nature.
Wow, yeah.
I think they did let him join when he was like 14.
Okay.
But he had a promise not to use bought fertilizer.
You know, to be a organic farmer, especially after the society in general is been so trained into, okay, here's how you solve your problems, and it's chemically, there has to have been a lot of knowledge lost throughout that conversion.
There has been really a lot lost. Martin was fortunate because his uncle's parent passed on a lot to him. And, you know, he grew up in Eagan there. Eagan and Mendota Heights and Grove, they were the eastern ring around the Twin Cities, and they were still producing a lot of the food for the Twin Cities in the 50s and 60s. Until late 70s, the grocery stores in the Twin Cities would still send trucks to the farmer's market and buy off the market to fill the shelves. That stopped in the late 70s.
Yeah, and I believe that, as I understand it, Martin's process of supplying all these co-ops was probably on the leading edge of that.
Yeah, it really was, because when the co-ops were starting in the early 70s, they too were sending trucks to the farmer's market. There wasn't a warehouse where they could purchase that would serve their smaller needs very easily. They had to do pickup. There really wasn't like a delivery system that they could tap into. So Martin was going to the farmer's market. He started selling there in 1973, and that's where he hooked up with those co-op buyers. And he figured he could start a delivery route and save them both the trip of going to the farmer's market. So that was how that started.
And it just moved from there, and eventually it became a partnership where the co-ops, the customers, and you as a supplier would get together and map out the year.
Mm-hmm. We always got together in the middle of winter and really looked at what each other's needs were and how we could meet them. So it was a really valuable relationship, and those types of relationships are really key to changing these food systems. The farmers can't do it on their own. The stores can't do it on their own. It really is a food system and a community effort.
And so working together was the way that you were able to develop a larger and larger, more productive business, and they were able to serve more people.
Yeah, and by being so consistent as a farmer, that was very educational to the customers, because they could count on the food, they could try new varieties, and then come back and try them again. That level of consistency is really key to developing a market. Now, today, there's over 65,000 co-op food members in the Twin Cities.
Wow. That's a lot of folks.
And they're supporting a lot of organic and local farmers.
Mm-hmm. I remember this just flipped something in my memory, reading as you were preparing for that lawsuit, I believe you had to figure out how many servings you served in a year, and it was, 2.5 million or something?
Yeah, it was close to 3 million servings coming off about 45 acres of production.
Isn't that amazing?
So it was great to think about it that way. I'd always thought of it in terms of dollars or pounds of produce, but to think of it in terms of servings and to picture families around a table eating corn, sweet corn or watermelon, foods that really make people happy, that really made it alive.
Right away in your book, Atina, one kind of got the, and I mentioned drama early on and the passion that you've put into this because it's such a passionate part of your life was the big hailstorm that ruined your crop early on in the book, and it was just like, I mean, anybody reading that would feel quite deeply the way that you felt because of the way that you were able to convey it.
Mm-hmm.
And I found that reading your book, you really are great at telling stories. I kind of almost felt like you were sitting next to me. That's the way that it reads off the pages. Had you written before? Had you had any other experience?
No, I wrote just for myself as sort of a healing tool. I find writing to be really healing and really sorting of my thoughts. It helps me separate what's emotion from what's reality. But no, I had never written anything like that. And it was really burning to come out of me, a story that really needed to be told. Someone told me once to write a book, you have to believe the world needs it. So I decided the world did. And I kind of laugh and say, it doesn't have to be true. I just have to believe it. So I decided to believe it. But my goal really was, I really learned a lot in that writing process that people, if you want to influence their behavior, they have to feel it. They have to feel your experience. So my goal really was to put the reader into my experience. And I've had this incredible opportunity in my life. A lot of people think about wanting to farm, and it is a dream for so many people, but they just don't have that opportunity. So it was really, I was able to then share that opportunity that I had. That felt really like a gift to me, to be able to do that. You know, the hailstorm is great because there was a big hailstorm down here a few nights ago.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a middle of the night hailstorm, much like the one in my book. And I got emails from a number of farmers who woke up in the middle of the night and had just read the scene in my book a few days earlier. And they were able to say, oh, yeah, we're going to be okay. Life is inherently resilient. The crops will come back. Mm-hmm. Because they had just read my own experience.
So
valuable to be able to articulate it, and that someone else can. It's almost as if the reader gets to have the experience and the lesson and then move forward from it.
You know, most people who have read about you or remember what happened in 2006 and 2007 would think first when they're thinking about this book being written about the kale versus coke, soil versus oil lawsuit, the David and Goliath kind of affair with you trying to stop this energy conglomerate from putting a pipeline through your new farm. But actually, as I read the book, I felt the very dramatic moment and the one that really might have prompted your book would be when you lost the first farm.
Yeah, exactly. You know, during the lawsuit with the Koch brothers, my attorney said to me, this is the perfect storm. You wouldn't be able to fight the Koch brothers now if you hadn't been through the loss of your first farm. And I really didn't know what she was talking about until I wrote the book. And then it was so obvious to me, because I didn't know I was still carrying that much pain from the loss of the first farm.
Mm-hmm.
And when I started writing that scene, you know, the first farm being bulldozed and all the life just was taken, every tree, every bush, every blade of grass. They even sold the living topsoil.
That's the part that when I read that, I thought, I didn't realize they did that. You know, they plowed up all that soil that you had spent how many generations to create and so much life to come out of, and sold it in bags.
And that the Native Americans had lived on for how many thousands of years, mm-hmm. and not destroyed.
Yeah, all gone. And it was we should explain to folks, it was an eminent domain portion of it for a school to be built, and then the balance of the land was sold for development as it was too small for your farm then.
So, what really forced the sale of the rest of the land was sewer and water assessments.
Oh.
It came across the rest of the land to serve the school, and that forced the sale.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, when I started writing those development scenes, I wrote, so there's maybe 70 pages of development scene. I wrote the first draft in 4 days. I didn't really know that was going to come out like that. It was just whoosh, came out. And then I read them to Martin, and we just sat and sobbed. And, you know, we got on with our lives when it happened. We had children to raise. We had a farm to put together. We had crops to grow, a business to run. We really didn't have time to go back and deal with the loss. So it really wasn't until I wrote those scenes that I really understood how huge the loss was.
Yeah, here you'd made these connections with all of your suppliers, and as you mentioned, it has to be consistent so they could count on it. Now you didn't have a farm, so you had to rent, 18 different sites in order to run between these places just to keep your suppliers going while you find another farm.
It was really a management nightmare at a 30-mile radius, and that was because we would only rent land that was certifiable as organic land. We could have gotten, you know, land on one piece if we would have accepted non-organic land. But we were organic farmers. We weren't going to do that. it really was the frog put into a bucket of cold water and having it slowly heated. It was really a crisis for our family.
Yeah, and you had two children who were, you know, they grew up with that land, very much
they
a part of their lives.
And, that land, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So it was a major transformation, as you say, and it shows how resilient your family was to, you know, go out on a limb again. And then when you get the new farm going, which seemed to be even more productive than your initial one, then Coke comes along with a pipeline. And you didn't even know about it until you just happened to open something that looked like junk mail.
We have a joke going here. The wrath of Atina Diffley.
Oh.
You don't want to face it. I was so mad.
Uh-huh.
When I went, after I received the letter from the cook on the pipeline, and I went online to learn more, and I started reading what's called the Agricultural Impact Mitigation Plan. This is a plan by which they go through and put the pipeline in and put everything back together and supposedly make it as it was before they came through. But one of the conditions in the Agricultural Impact Mitigation Plan was that the Mincan pipeline would not knowingly allow more than 12 inches of topsoil erosion. Can you imagine saying that to an organic farmer?
Hmm.
That was the moment where I knew there was just no question that I would fight that no matter what it cost me.
Yeah, where would you turn next? I mean, to start all over again would have been just too much.
We'd already started over once.
Yeah.
We weren't 25 anymore.
Mm-hmm.
We weren't going to start over again. If it went through, we would have shut down.
But you did an astounding amount of work in preparing for that lawsuit, and your lawyer found another passionate person, Paula Maccabee, I believe.
Yep.
And formed a team that took on Goliath, and you won.
It's really important to know something. When I decided that I needed an attorney and I started looking, I pulled up a list of eminent domain attorneys in the Twin Cities. It was a long list, 40, 50 attorneys. And I started at the top and started moving down that list. And every single one told me, I'm sorry, we can't help you. We have a conflict of interest.
Yeah, they were already in the grasp of Goliath.
Yeah, so that just made me madder, that it was that hard for a landowner to have a meaningful impact. And when I found Paula and I asked her why she wasn't retained and tied up, she said, oh, I don't represent polluters. So I knew I had the right woman.
Mm-hmm.
And then she said, Gardens Vegan, organic farm, crude oil pipeline, 12 inches of topsoil erosion? This is going to be fun.
Well, I don't know about fun, but it was fun that you won. Let's put it that way.
Well, when she said that, I knew I had the right gal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We could have never succeeded without the support of our customers. Over 4,500 people wrote letters to the judge, and they weren't letters of rhetoric or anger. They were informed citizen input. They were articulate. They explained how organic farming systems worked. They talked about the relationship that they and their families had with the farm, what the food meant to them, why it couldn't be replaced by another of like kind. They really made a big difference. And that shocked Paula, my attorney. She asked early on if we could get 200 letters. And I said, Paula, we can get that in half a day, one day. People really respond when their food is threatened.
Mm-hmm.
And she didn't know that because it's the same issue as air and water. It's about preserving these things. But she didn't understand how people will act when it's their food. So that was really amazing, and that made a huge difference.
Since that time, you've sold your farm to one of your customers, actually, the Wedge Community Co-op. You've changed your life considerably. I know I read in a Tribune, Star Tribune article that it took you 3 days to, or 3 years actually, to quit putting dirty clothes on in the morning because you kept thinking you were still farming.
I was in a servant identity crisis. No, but we sold our name, the name of our business, Gardens Vegan, and the equipment they needed to the Wedge Co-op. But we didn't sell our land. We still own our land, and we still live here. They've been they hired a manager, and she's run the farm with the crew. And then this fall, they're moving to their own land that they purchased. So we'll have management of our land back. So that's all been really great. We wanted to do other things with our lives. We still loved farming, but we wanted to develop other parts of ourselves. I wanted to become a writer. I think I did it. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to break up patterns and just really have more personal growth and not just do one thing my entire life. But it was a really big decision because it was such a big part of our identity and really did take time to go through that process.
My co-host, Bob Carter, has a question for you.
Yeah, Atina, I'm assuming that the Diffley of your Martin's family is the Diffley after which Diffley Road is named.
It is. You know, when that road went through, until the 40s and 50s, a lot of the roads in rural areas really were just field roads through people's farms. So where that road went through was the field road through the Diffley farm.
Yeah.
And then the Diffley family donated the land for a portion of it.
I used to live in South St. Paul, and we had a business in Emery Grove Heights, and I remember for years buying agricultural products, produce, from truck farms out along Robert Street, mm-hmm. and there were a lot of them.
There were a lot.
Yeah, those were great days.
Mm-hmm. It was really the vegetable source for the Twin Cities. It was really a loss.
Yeah.
You know, the development story in my book is just one farm. That was repeated hundreds of times just in those two townships. And then you multiply that towards the state, then you think about the entire country, and you get a staggering amount of loss. We had viable food systems in this country.
Yep.
And, you know, that happened in Eagan because the city of Eagan had not left any land zoned for agriculture. They didn't really recognize it as necessary. They weren't talking about food security and stability in the 80s. It was boom, 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 let's build more houses. So it's real exciting now to see what's happening because jurisdictions are recognizing the importance of food production. And we're really at early stages of it, but it's happening everywhere. Up by you in Silver Bay, there's a fish industry going in. David Abbas worked on that. And they've got greens, too, that are being fertilized by the fish. This is happening all across the country. It's really exciting.
You know, Atina, we would love to have you up here as well, and you may be hearing from our local folk school at some point. And I know that you're traveling as a speaker, working as a speaker and an educator, and there's so much more that we could talk about here, but unfortunately we're running short of time. But I would like folks to be able to go to your blog and your website to learn more.
That's great.
Could you let us know?
Yeah, it's atinadiffley.com. That's atinadiffley.com. And I have a blog they can subscribe to. It's got pages of resources for farmers, some of the really good links to the information they'll need to farm. There's a great resource page for consumers. All the workshops I give are listed there. They could spend a lot of time reading there. There's lots of great information.
Well, that's just great. I want to thank you so much for giving us your time tonight, and I want to also recommend to everybody that it's a book well worth picking up, and that is Turn Here, Sweet Corn, and that's available, I imagine, just about anywhere where you buy books.
Anywhere you buy books, and I think you've got a little bookstore there in Grand Marais that's carrying it.
Oh, great. Yeah, we have a couple of them here in town, and I'm sure they can, if they can't get it off the shelf, they could sure order it.
They sure can.
We've been speaking with Atina Diffley, and as I mentioned at the start, Atina now is an organic consultant, an educator, a public speaker, and, of course, author of the book that we've been talking about. Until 2008, she and her husband, Martin, ran Gardens of Eagan, and I know folks even up here in this far north have been eating your products for years as well through our local co-op. Atina, thank you again so much.
Thank you so much. Bye.
Bye-bye.